Ah, good. All right, so good morning. This is Bio 241, and it is October 8th, and just got done with your second test. We're going to start autonomic nervous system today. From the beginning, let's see, there are a number of people that put their tests in the wrong lab section, so when I was uploading their grades to Blackboard, I didn't have a spot to put your grade because it was in the wrong pile. So probably by early next week, I'll be able to figure out what pile you belong in or what lab you belong in. And so don't send me a whole bunch of emails. So next time, just try to really think what lab you're in. And if you're Tuesday at 8 o'clock, put it in the Tuesday at 8 o'clock section, right? Not the Thursday at 8 o'clock, because I don't even have a big enough office to spread all those papers out and put them in the right pile, right? So that's why a lot of people didn't get their grades in Blackboard. So I'll get to that as soon as I possibly can. All right, but there are a couple other people that I do have your tests. So you might see me right after class, all right, because I have your tests graded. And I'll be happy to show you those. All right, so autonomic nervous system. Let's get started with that. And that's chapter 9. All right, so we could break your body down into two main categories. Categories that you can control with your conscious thoughts and other parts of your body that you can't control with your conscious thoughts. So how would we talk about those two different parts of your body scientifically in terms of physiology or even anatomy? There's different ways. Central versus peripheral. Well, that's a nice anatomic definition of the nervous system, right? But central just means brain and spinal cord, and peripheral means everything else outside that. So that's two ways you could break your body down, but that's not what I'm thinking of. There's a better way. Okay. Sympathetic, parasympathetic. Those are divisions of something that automatically take care of your body for you. Oh, now I'm getting to where I'm beginning to recall some information now. Yes, right? For instance, somatic versus autonomic, and you could say automatic for autonomic, but that wouldn't be the proper term. All right, but what kinds of organs in your body are controlled via the somatic nervous system? And somatic really means, you guys are right on, somatic really means what? Voluntary. What you have under voluntary control, that is your somatic nervous system. And you guys just said, what is the only thing that is controlled voluntarily by you? That is your skeletal muscle. Okay. Everything else in your body is controlled by the autonomic nervous system. And then you should have some criteria in your mind what makes up those autonomic organs that are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Or you could think of maybe visceral as opposed to somatic organs like skeletal muscle. So what are some of the autonomic organs that you don't have control over? Smooth muscle, that's fantastic. Glands, and another kind of muscle, which is cardiac muscle. Right, so somatic nervous system controls skeletal muscle, autonomic nervous system controls glands, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. All right, so what do you think makes up more of your body? Skeletal muscle or cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands together? You know what? It is glands, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. So the autonomic nervous system, I'm trying to just tell you, is a very important nervous system because it's controlling most of what's happening inside your body. Right? And the somatic nervous system just controls a little bit. All right, and especially when you're asleep, the somatic nervous system doesn't really control anything, right? Because you're asleep, you're not conscious. So autonomic nervous system is of prime importance for maintaining homeostasis. So we give it a whole chapter by itself. I bet it is, but I think maybe I have to turn it on. Okay, thank you. All right, so let me get my pointer options working right here. All right, so chapter 9. We're going to look at the difference between the somatic and autonomic nervous system in terms of its neurons, the divisions of the autonomic nervous system, and you already told me that there are two main divisions. We'll look at some neurotransmitters and how these neurotransmitters affect different organ systems in the body. All right, so the autonomic nervous system manages our physiology by maintaining homeostasis of what? Smooth muscle, glands, and what should you include on this slide? Cardiac muscle. Yeah, pencil that in. You should put those three divisions right there. And one strange thing about all of these organs that are innervated by the autonomic nervous system, if for any reason that innervation is damaged or lost, all right, those glands become hyperactive. Right? They don't lose activity. They actually become more active. We call that denervation hypersensitivity. Right? And especially smooth muscle. And smooth muscle, many kinds of smooth muscle, are spontaneously active. Even without innervation, they will contract by themselves. And that is completely dislike the somatic nervous system. Okay, I punched the on button, but I see it's not on yet.
It came on
and then went off?
Yeah.
Oh, that's bad. Yeah, I see a light on. But it's not bright. Maybe if I turn all the lights off. Okay, let's turn it off. And then I'll turn it back on. But maybe the bulb burned out. Okay. All right, so here's another kind of important concept. And I'm talking specifically about smooth muscle. And it's got to go through a little cycle. All right, smooth muscle will contract on its own periodically in a rhythmic fashion, or some types of smooth muscle. And what the autonomic nervous system does is that it regulates that period of contraction or the autorhythmicity of it. So it can maybe increase the rhythmicity or decrease the rhythmicity. It only adjusts the rate, but it doesn't necessarily tell us smooth muscle when to contract. And that's very similar with the heart, cardiac muscle. All right? Because what do you know about the heart? If you were to excise a heart out of a mammalian body and put it on the table, what is this going to do? Just like Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's going to beat. Yeah, the heart is going to beat by itself. The heart does not need innervation. Right? What the nerves do that go to the heart is that it makes fine adjustments to the force of contraction and the rate of contraction. All right, let's try this again. See what happens. Okay, so the autonomic nervous system in some kinds of muscle, smooth muscle and cardiac muscle, just adjust its irritability properties. Okay, we're about ready to turn back on right here. But I didn't, did you hear it go bloop? Did it make a noise back there?
A while ago,
but not again, huh? Maybe it will. All right. Well, maybe you have your notes, and maybe not, so I'm going to just draw a couple little diagrams as that thing gets turned on. All right, so here we got, what do we got right here? Ah, what does that look like? That looks like a brain, right? Okay, absolutely. Frontal lobe, temporal lobe, parietal lobe, occipital lobe. Okay, then we've got spinal cord right here. Then we got a level of the spinal cord. And nothing's happening with the projector. Let's put here a skeletal muscle. And what kind of skeletal muscle do we want this to be like? All right, so here's a nice skeletal muscle. The fascicles are all nice and parallel. So if you're going to name that muscle, what would you call that? Yeah, biceps brachii, fantastic. Ah, I heard it go now. Maybe it's going to turn back on. All right, so nerves leave the spinal cord to this muscle right here, and there's two ways in and out of the spinal cord, right? And so here is, let's just say this is posterior right here. This is anterior. It's coming on. Great. Anterior. All right, so these are the two ways that signals can enter and leave the spinal cord. And how do signals leave the spinal cord? Is it posteriorly or anteriorly? Right? It's through the ventral root. right? So these are roots, go through the ventral root. So there is a neuron cell body right here, okay, in the anterior dorsal gray matter, gray horn. And for skeletal muscle, right, then it, so these are the roots, this is the spinal nerve that leaves the spinal cord, and it goes all the way to the skeletal muscle where it innervates that skeletal muscle. So how many neurons does it take to get from CNS to this effector organ, which is skeletal muscle? It just requires one for the somatic nervous system, right? So this is a somatic output pathway. Now what about for an autonomic pathway? That requires two. All right, so so it leaves, for instance, it's going to leave the central nervous system. I don't want to say if it's spinal cord or brain. So we have, it's got to leave the ventral root because that's the motor root no matter what, if it's somatic or autonomic. All right, and then it's going to stop someplace. And it's going to synapse on a second neuron, which is then going to go to an effector organ, like maybe the heart, or maybe some smooth muscle in the eye, or smooth muscle in the stomach or something. So an autonomic pathway has two fibers back to back, right? And this first fiber right here, what do we call this first fiber? The preganglionic fiber, and this is the then postganglionic fiber. Okay. Preganglionic, postganglionic fiber, and so this thing right here is the ganglion. Right? That's the ganglion right there. Let's try turning the lights off. Not exactly good. Okay. All right, so that's a typical autonomic pathway. All right, so this right here, this communication between the preganglionic and postganglionic, what do we call the structural and functional unit of communication between cells?
Synapse.
That's a synapse. All right, and remember we have two kinds of synapses, electrical and chemical. And this one right here in particular is a chemical synapse. So what's the general name of the chemical that's going to move across the synapse and carry information from the preganglionic to the postganglionic cell? That's a neurotransmitter, okay? And the neurotransmitter that is always used, right, at this synapse, at the ganglion, is acetylcholine. So I'm going to put ACH right here. It's going to be acetylcholine. That's the neurotransmitter. So this preganglionic fiber is what we call cholinergic. It's cholinergic because it uses acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. All right. So let's think. How many different divisions of the autonomic nervous system are there? I don't know if anybody had done any of the pre-lecture reading assignment at all. Oh, I don't have it in this class. Okay. The two divisions, all right, here's one. This is what we call the sympathetic. And the second one is the parasympathetic. All right, but in either case, whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, it requires what? Two neurons to get to the effector organ, which could be what? Cardiac muscle, glands, or smooth muscle in either particular case. All right, the other thing you should know about autonomic outflow from the autonomic nervous system is that it is significantly different between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, so that the sympathetic nervous system, the outflow is what we call thoracolumbar. That means that sympathetic nerves leave through the thoracic spinal nerves or lumbar spinal nerves, but Parasympathetic stimulation leaves through what we call cranial sacral outflow. So there are some cranial nerves that carry parasympathetic information, and then there are some sacral nerves, right? But there's nothing in the thorax or lumbar region of the spinal cord. So those are the two main differences. Okay, so we're just going to, the projector looks like it's getting brighter, but I don't know if it's really going to turn on or not. Okay, so let me erase this down here. All right, so let's just show you another case. So here is a spinal cord. Here is a preganglionic fiber. And let's say this one is going to go all the way to the heart. So here's the heart. Here's the postganglionic fiber. All right, so this would be an example of parasympathetic. All right, and we still know this is an autonomic pathway. How do we know that this is still an autonomic pathway? Because there's two neurons back to back. Okay, and at the ganglion right here, which is right on the surface of the heart, since this is parasympathetic, all right, what is going to be the neurotransmitter that's used here? Acetylcholine, right? So it doesn't matter if it's sympathetic or parasympathetic. So let's just say that this first diagram that I drew right here will be sympathetic outflow. There's something else that maybe you remember. This is just kind of a review from anatomy. And the preganglionic fiber for the parasympathetic nervous system is relatively long. The preganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system is short, which means for the parasympathetic nervous system, the postganglionic fiber is really short, and the postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic outflow is long. Okay, so you got some really good pictures in your book that show that. All right, now here is where there's another difference, and that is these synapses on the effector organs are chemical synapses as well. So they require what for transmission of information from the postganglionic fiber into the effector organ? They require a neurotransmitter, right? Okay, and here the neurotransmitters are different. For the parasympathetic nervous system, okay, these postganglionic fibers release acetylcholine. All right, so both of these neurons right here, the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers, are what we call cholinergic fibers. These are cholinergic. All right, but the neurotransmitter that's released at the postganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system is norepinephrine. All right, so this postganglionic fiber is not a cholinergic fiber because it doesn't release acetylcholine. It's what we call adrenergic. This is an adrenergic fiber because it uses norepinephrine. All right, I probably want to mention one other little last thing about some of this anatomy. Okay, these ganglia for the sympathetic nervous system are arranged bilaterally on either side of the vertebral column. And they form a chain, like a link of pearls or something, that are all interconnected. And those are called the sympathetic chain ganglia. All right, so just have to look at a picture in your book to see sympathetic chain ganglia. And those chain ganglia are only going to participate in what? Sympathetic outflow. No parasympathetic outflow whatsoever. Okay, but in every case, acetylcholine is going to be used as a neurotransmitter. All right, let me draw another figure. So even if I had a book, I couldn't project any of these figures. So here we have a spinal cord, and here we have different ganglia in the thoracic region, right? And they're interconnected with each other, like this. And we could have the heart here. What does that look like? Okay, I just want to make sure you guys are tracking with me. That's not so important. But this little organ here is. What's right on top of the kidney? Adrenal gland. Okay. And let's just put an eyeball right here. Okay, we've got the heart. And then we'll put some intestines here as well. And here we have a sympathetic nerve, and maybe I'll put this in blue. We have a sympathetic nerve leaving the spinal cord, going into the sympathetic chain ganglia, and this one nerve, okay, will branch. So it might actually go right to the intestine, okay, and another branch might go up here and go to the heart, right, and go to the eye. And another branch might go down over here to the adrenal gland. So the sympathetic nervous system, when it becomes activated, it has a tendency to go everywhere in the body, right? Because of, if these signals are splitting up, we call this divergence. So when the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, pretty much all of these organs get activated all at one time. That's not so for the parasympathetic nervous system. The parasympathetic nervous system is very selective. It can go to the heart by itself or to the intestines by itself. So because of divergence, sometimes we consider the sympathetic nervous system, it's controlled by mass activation. And there's something else that contributes to that effect. When sympathetic nerves go to the adrenal gland, okay, and in particular, so let's just say that here's the preganglionic fiber, here's the postganglionic fiber, okay, and to the adrenal gland, let's just say that there is one fiber that goes directly without synapsing in the sympathetic chain. And then the cells of the adrenal medulla right here release chemicals directly into the blood. So here is a preganglionic fiber. And this little cell right here really is the postganglionic. All right, so here's pre, here's post, here's pre, and here's post. All right, so here, this little scheme right here going to the adrenal gland is quite a bit different, right, because this cell is not sending electrical impulses over long distances like typically we find on a postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system. This cell directly releases epinephrine and norepinephrine right in the cell, and then these compounds are picked up by capillaries. All right, and when it's picked up by a capillary, where does epinephrine and norepinephrine go? It goes in the blood. And where does the blood go? Everywhere in your body. So that really just continues the theme of sympathetic innervation as being what? Very divergent, because it goes everywhere in the body. Okay, so what are some of the effects of the sympathetic nervous system on your body? Okay, well, let's generally characterize sympathetic as the fight or flight nervous system. And the parasympathetic as, there's two different ways people talk about it, but it's rest and we'll say digest in here. Rest and digest nervous system. Or you could say rest and repose nervous system. Yeah. Ah, okay. So this is kind of interesting because here at this synapse, this is a classical neurotransmitter. It's a neurotransmitter because it's released by the preganglionic neuron, goes across the synapse, and it stimulates and produces EPSPs on the postganglionic fiber, which then carry action potentials everywhere to the effector organs. All right, but for the adrenal medulla, all right, here's a preganglionic fiber. There are action potentials coming here. All right, acetylcholine is released. So these cells right here are acting like, what, this postganglionic fiber, but they don't carry electrical impulses anywhere. So this is really not a neuron. It's releasing a signaling molecule that's picked up directly into the blood, and it's carried to receptors all over the body. So in this particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine are acting more like a hormone than a neurotransmitter. All right, so this is true. We can't really characterize this cell right here that's called a chromaffin cell. We can't really characterize that as a neuron. But this shows the importance of the link, the interaction between the nervous system and the endocrine system. Right? And as a matter of fact, in a lot of classes, when you study control of the body, you don't study the nervous system and then the endocrine system. It's all combined together because there are a number of places in your body where you can't really make a distinction if something is acting like a hormone or a neurotransmitter. It has characteristics of both. Okay, but because it goes into the blood acting like a hormone, it has a longer duration of action. So when you have norepinephrine or epinephrine in the blood, it lasts a lot longer than, say, norepinephrine within the synapse. The duration in the synapse is very, very short-lived because of reuptake and monoamine oxidase and COMT and the other mechanisms that we looked at in the last chapter. Okay, so that's an interesting point. Okay, that epinephrine and norepinephrine can act as a hormone if it's released from the adrenal medulla, but in other cases it acts classically as a neurotransmitter. Right, but this scheme right here just shows that when this norepinephrine goes everywhere in the body, that does what? That's showing that it's activating all the sympathetic receptors in the body via mass activation, and that's just a sign of what? Divergence of the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so let's talk about sympathetic and parasympathetic. So sympathetic, all right, what happens to you when you're presented with like a life-threatening situation? Maybe you were driving to school today and you're between two semi-tractor trucks and there was a lot of traffic, and all of a sudden one of the big trucks wanted to change lanes, but you're right in that lane, right? It looked like you were going to get crushed by these big trucks. Okay, so what happens to you? Maybe that has happened to you when you're in a circumstance and for sure you think you're going to die. Okay, that didn't happen to me this morning, but thank God. All right, so what happens to your heart rate? It increases. It goes way up. But what else about your heart? Not only the rate, but maybe you can't remember. How's it operating inside your chest? It's like almost jumping outside your chest because it's beating so forcefully. Okay, so the rate goes up, but the force of contraction goes up as well. All right, so that's due to sympathetic stimulation on the heart. There are some other things that happen too. What about your perspiration rate? It increases, all right? And what about your pupil diameter? The pupil is controlled by the iris, okay? And your iris dilates. Your eyes get really, really big, so that lets in a lot of light so that you can see what's happening to you, all right? Also, what happens is that blood flow to skeletal muscle increases, right? Because you need to react to that particular threat. You need to contract skeletal muscle to get away, to protect yourself. And what does skeletal muscle need to contract vigorously? Well, it needs glucose and it needs oxygen, right, to keep aerobic respiration working. So those blood vessels are dilating, and you can react to that particular threat. But you know what? You don't have enough blood in your body to go everywhere. Your body has to select where it's going to go. So if you need a lot of blood to go to the heart, right, when it's stimulated due to some threatful circumstance or to skeletal muscle so that you can use skeletal muscle a lot, and to glands because you're perspiring, you don't have enough blood to go to the digestive tract. So if you were going to make a call on where this blood should go when you're trying to get away from a mortal situation, should it be going to your digestive tract or to your heart and skeletal muscle? Yeah, heart and skeletal muscle, because your digestive processes can wait until you know you're going to be alive, right? Absolutely. So blood goes to skeletal muscle, doesn't go to your digestive tract, so blood flow is actually diverted away from your intestines because that's not where you need blood at that particular time. All right, so that's why we call the parasympathetic nervous system the rest and digest, because the parasympathetic nervous system activates or is stimulatory to the digestive system. And it stimulates other processes in your body when you're at rest. Right, it cuts off blood supply to skeletal muscles when you're not working them. All right, and it goes to the eyes, for instance, and it helps constrict the iris, so the pupil gets smaller. All right, so in general, the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, okay, they work in opposition to each other. And what do we call that term? When you have, antagonism, right? So the autonomic nervous system is based on antagonism. And that's because most organs have dual innervation. That means that it gets nerve supply from both sympathetic nerves and parasympathetic nerves, and they both will have an effect, say, on the heart. So what is a heart know how to do? It looks at both of these signals, right? And it finds a balance between them, and it finds the correct rate based on the input of both of these two systems right here. Okay, so what's the beauty about having an antagonistic system on your heart? So you think it's pretty important to be able to control your heart rate and force of contraction? Yeah, because otherwise you're going to pass out all the time, right? And the only way you can have that precise control and balance over an organ is if the control system is based on antagonism, right? So you kind of covered that in your first lab, right? If you want water at a certain temperature, you can't just turn on one faucet. What do you got to turn on? Hot and cold to get the temperature you want, right? So the same thing for the heart. The heart, right, the sympathetic is excitatory on the heart. The parasympathetic is inhibitory on the heart. So that is antagonistic. But that's not to say that the sympathetic is always going to be excitatory on every particular organ. And another really good example would be With the parasympathetic nervous system, that's going to be excitatory on the digestive system. So that's going to enhance motility. It's going to enhance secretions of the digestive system, while the sympathetic is going to inhibit motility and inhibit secretions of the digestive system. Right? So you can't always say sympathetic is excitatory and parasympathetic is inhibitory. You should just know that generally they are what? Opposite to each other. If you know the action of one on an organ, then you can infer what the action of the other nervous system is going to be on that particular organ. And a good way to always try to figure out if it's going to be excitatory or inhibitory is to think of the fight or flight response versus the rest and digest. And just think, well, what should this organ be doing if you're in a life-threatening situation? Should it be activated or should it be put in reserve for a later time? Okay? Or like your eyes. When you're in a life-threatening situation, should your pupils constrict so that you can't see? Or should they dilate so that you can see a lot? Okay, so always rely on these two little quips right here to help you get a appreciation for whether an organ is going to be stimulated by sympathetic or inhibited by sympathetic stimulation. Okay. Oh, look at all these good pictures right here. Okay. Okay, so for autonomic nervous system, in anatomy, you looked at the neuromuscular junction, and we looked at some chemical synapses in the previous chapter last time. And so the typical kind of synapse that you see, all right, if this is the effector organ right here, and here is a nerve coming down, then what kind of specializations happen in this axon terminus to form a chemical synapse? There's got to be an enlargement to it, right? We call that a button or a bouton. Bouton terminale, and then there's got to be synaptic vesicles with neurotransmitter. All right, so there's this bulge right on the tip of an axon. All right, so that's the classical kind of synapse that we've seen before, and that's what a neuromuscular junction looks like. But for many other organs that are innervated by the autonomic nervous system, this is not what we have. We don't have synaptic vesicles just at the end of the axon. All right, so let me draw what it might look like over here. So, for instance, let's think of some smooth muscle someplace, like some intestine someplace. Okay, so here we have smooth muscle cells, bunches of smooth muscle cells within the small intestine. And nerves, like sympathetic nerves, will come down and not just stimulate one cell, right? There's going to be a little bulb right here, all right? And then there's going to be another piece of axon and another little bulge right here and another little bulge right here. And these all contain synaptic vesicles. So when an action potential comes down, these synaptic vesicles will be released from this first bulge and second bulge and third bulge and will stimulate all of these cells together. These little bulges are what we call varicosities. All right, so synaptic vesicles aren't contained just in the axon terminus, but through long segments of the axon as it passes through the organ that it's innervating. So the anatomy of the synapse is quite a bit different. All right, so this could be sympathetic, and then we can have parasympathetic nerves come as well, and there could be varicosities here filled with neurotransmitter. All right, so parasympathetic. What did we say the action of parasympathetic stimulation was on smooth muscle of the digestive tract? Is it going to increase motility or decrease motility? It's going to increase. Remember, parasympathetic is rest and digest nervous system. All right, and so this is going to be, so this is the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic nervous system. This is the postganglionic for sympathetic. What's the neurotransmitter that's being used at this parasympathetic fiber right here? Acetylcholine. So would we call this a cholinergic neuron or an adrenergic neuron? That's cholinergic. All right, so here is acetylcholine. What's the neurotransmitter released here? Norepinephrine, right? So I'm just going to say norepinephrine. All right, so now why is it that acetylcholine can be stimulatory, but norepinephrine can be inhibitory? What would you use to explain that to somebody? How could you explain that to somebody? In terms of, the receptor, say in terms of different ions or ion channels. Typically, what kind of ion channel is excitatory? Sodium. It's a sodium channel. All right, so here we're going to have some ligand-gated sodium channel. So when acetylcholine is released, those sodium channels open up. All right, so sodium can enter these cells, depolarize them, and so that's going to be excitatory. How would you explain how norepinephrine can actually inhibit these same cells right here? Because they're going to have a ligand-gated channel, but in this particular case, the channel is going to be a potassium channel. So in this particular case, potassium will leave the cell and hyperpolarize it. All right, and so the way that this smooth muscle cell is going to react is going to be based on what? The combination of sodium entering and potassium leaving until it finds its particular level of control, right? Because that shows antagonistic control right there. So cardiac muscle works the same way, smooth muscle works the same way. Okay. All right, furthermore, in the sympathetic nervous system, all right, so the neurotransmitter that's used in the sympathetic nervous system is norepinephrine. And in some parts of the body, norepinephrine can actually excite a tissue or it can inhibit a tissue, depending on the particular kind of receptor. So norepinephrine can be excitatory. All right, so I'll say it can excite or it can inhibit. So how could you explain how one particular neurotransmitter, how in one circumstance could it be excitatory and inhibitory in another case? Because there might be different receptors, right? And one receptor might open up a sodium channel, and another receptor, even though it's got the same binding site for norepinephrine, might maybe open up a chlorine channel or a potassium channel inhibiting that cell. All right, so there are different kinds of receptors for the autonomic nervous system, right? They're not just all cholinergic or adrenergic receptors. And for the sympathetic nervous system, the two main subtypes are what we call alpha receptors and beta receptors. Okay, so I'll eventually show you some pretty nice figures of these different kinds of receptors. And these are not just ligand-gated channels, but these all work through G-protein-coupled receptors. you have a picture in your mind of what a G protein coupled receptor is? Okay. And G protein coupled receptors, remember that norepinephrine doesn't enter the cell. It binds to a receptor that's on the cell membrane. And then there's something else that gets triggered inside the cell that causes a change in metabolism inside the cell. What do we call a buildup of that chemical inside the cell? The hint is norepinephrine would be the first messenger. And then inside the cell, you're going to have a second messenger. So the level of this second messenger is going to increase due to the G protein coupled reaction when norepinephrine binds to the receptor. All right, and there are two kinds of second messengers. And we looked at one. One is cyclic AMP. It is a second messenger. And in others, it is calcium. Calcium can be used as a signal to change metabolism inside the cell. Okay, and I sort of wrote it backwards. All of the alpha receptors use calcium as a second messenger, and all of the beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So that's a nice distinction between alpha and beta. Okay. And I want to give you some actions, typical actions of what these different receptors do. All right, so there are subtypes of alpha and beta receptors. There is alpha 1 and alpha 2, and there is beta 1 and beta 2. So we're going to talk about actually three. I'm not going to actually mention much about the alpha 2 receptors unless I can get my slides going, but alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2 type receptors. All right, so these right here, all right, rely on what kind of second messenger? These are calcium, and these over here rely on cyclic AMP. All right, but nonetheless, they're all G protein coupled receptors. All right, the alpha 1 typically are excitatory, right? They cause depolarization of smooth muscle. All right, so they're excitatory. They're going to cause smooth muscle to contract. And so where we find alpha 1 receptors are mostly in blood vessels. Blood vessels. And these cause constriction of blood vessels when those smooth muscles contract. All right, and to give you a little hint of what that might mean for your body, all right, your body has to regulate blood pressure. It needs pressure so that blood flows from one region to the other. So picture a balloon that you have in your hands and squeeze down on the balloon. What's going to happen to the pressure inside that balloon as you squeeze down on it? Is it not going to change, or is it going to go up, or is it going to go down as you squeeze on it? Okay, that should be fairly intuitive, right? When you squeeze on something, all right, the pressure goes up. Or you could have your friend grab your finger and have your friend squeeze your finger and then tell me if you feel more pressure or less pressure when somebody's squeezing your hand or your finger, okay? When something squeezes down, pressure goes up. So when the alpha 1 receptors in blood vessels are stimulated, cause the blood vessel to constrict, what happens to somebody's blood pressure? It goes up. All right, so this is one way that your body helps regulate blood pressure via these alpha 1 receptors. All right, these alpha 2 we're not going to talk about right now. All right, so blood vessels. Beta 1 are excitatory on the heart. These will excite the heart. And there are two ways that the heart can be excited. It can be excited by force of contraction, and it can be excited by its rhythm, its rate of contraction. All right, so beta 1s will increase. Beta 1 are what we call, let me move this out of the way, positive, which means if it's positive, something's going to be increased. Chronotropic and inotropic. All right, so what does chrono mean? If you have a chronograph on your body, what do you have? What do you have? You got a watch, right? So chrono means time, right? So if something has a positive chronotropic effect, it's going to affect the heart rate. So it's going to increase heart rate. So if you were to count your pulse, it would be just faster. All right, if something is a positive inotropic agent, it's going to increase not the heart rate, but the force of contraction. So your heart is going to pound stronger. But because norepinephrine is both a positive chronotropic and inotropic effect, when you have epinephrine and norepinephrine in your body, what happens to your heart? It speeds up, but the force of contraction is also much stronger as well. That's why it feels like it's going to come pounding out of your chest. All right, so that's due to the beta 1 kind of receptor. So would you say inhibit beta 1 when it's stimulated? Is it inhibitory on the heart or excitatory? It's excitatory. So beta 1 is excitatory on the heart. All right, now beta 2. Where do we find beta 2 at? See if I can draw this out. Ah, what's that? Your lungs. Okay. And I have a little notch there for your heart. Okay. Now, beta 2 are receptors that are in bronchioles. So here's a bronchiole, and there's smooth muscle in bronchioles. And these smooth muscles can contract. What happens to the diameter of this bronchiole when this smooth muscle is excited into contracting? It decreases. Okay? And I don't know, maybe you had a drink somewhere that came with a little swizzle stick in it and it had like some really tiny holes, and maybe you tried to use it as a straw. So you tried to suck on a tiny, tiny little straw, and did you get any drink when you did that? You know what? Because the holes are so small, you hardly any at all. So you just have to throw that away and just drink it out of the glass as opposed to a straw. So as the diameter of this tube decreases, the flow through it decreases. Okay? So when there is bronchospasm, for instance, when these smooth muscles constrict, that reduces airflow to the lungs. And the way to reestablish that airflow is with a beta 2 agonist that will stimulate the beta 2 receptors, which then do what? They dilate the bronchiole. So beta 2 are inhibitory on these smooth muscles right here. So that will open up an airway. All right, so that explains why, okay, norepinephrine can be excitatory in some regions, but inhibitory in other regions of the body based on what? Different kinds of receptors. So the same neurotransmitter can have opposite effects because the receptors are different. All right, so the binding site is the same, but what is different? Beta 1 is going to be opening up sodium channels, but the beta 2 will be opening up potassium channels, are going to be inhibitory on the heart. Okay, so that's just some different classes of receptors. So what's an easy way to remember this? How are you going to remember that beta 1 works on the heart? Well, sympathetic, you should know, is on the heart. Probably before you took the class, is excitatory, right? All right, but how are you going to know beta 1 on the heart, beta 2 on the lungs? Well, because you have one heart and you've got two lungs. That's the easiest way to remember that, okay? And so, and I'm not going to actually ask you much about the difference between the alpha 1 and alpha 2 type receptors, but the alpha 1 pretty much all the time are excitatory on smooth muscle, okay, and other parts of the body. And then just remember that All norepinephrine receptors are G protein coupled receptors. The beta act through cyclic AMP, the alpha work through calcium release. Okay. So that's for adrenergic receptors. You know something about acetylcholine receptors already as well. Okay? I think in the last chapter we talked about nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors. So let me see what I can recall about that. Okay, so nicotinics. So I better erase this. Okay, so acetylcholine receptors. The first class is nicotinic. And nicotinic receptors are just plain old ligand gated channels. They're what we call ionotropic channels. That means when, if you have the plasma membrane right here, and here is a channel, here's a binding site for acetylcholine, and when acetylcholine binds to these two sites, then it opens up. And when that opens up, sodium can enter the cell, and that produces what? Depolarization, which is excitatory. So nicotinic receptors are excitatory in every particular case. So these kinds we could find, neuromuscular junction would be a good place, but also within the ganglionic cells, between the preganglionic and postganglionic fibers. Okay, and then we have the muscarinic kind. All right, and muscarinic kind are all G protein coupled. And they're a metabotropic kind of receptor. So when one acetylcholine binds to the receptor, two different possibilities exist. It could be excitatory or inhibitory. Inhibitory, for instance, on the heart. Excitatory in the digestive tract. All right, so in either case, what do we got? We've got the receptor in the membrane coupled to this G protein, right? Alpha, beta, gamma. When acetylcholine binds here, the alpha, beta, and gamma subunits start to wander around inside the membrane, and they can bind to different channels. In the heart, what kind of channel are they going to bind to and cause them to open? Okay, so in the heart, all right, so they're going to be a potassium channel. And in the digestive tract, it's going to be a sodium channel that opens up, that will excite, that will increase motility in the digestive tract. Okay, so again, a particular neurotransmitter can have opposite effects in the body depending on what? The different kinds of receptors and ion channels that are involved. Okay, so inhibition or excitation can be produced. And I'll have to mention this a number of times. So here we're talking about the heart. And the only effect acetylcholine has on the heart is a chronotropic effect. It has no Inotropic effect. All right, so let's go back to the sympathetic nervous system. We said when norepinephrine bound to receptors on the heart, what kind of receptors are on the heart? Beta 1, yeah, the beta 1 receptors on the heart. All right, what's the effect of stimulating beta 1 receptors on the heart? Two effects. Yeah, chronotropic effect and inotropic effect. The chronotropic effect is positive. It means increase heart rate. Positive inotropic effect means it increases force of contraction, right? The force of contraction is much more violent, more vigorous, right? So both of those go up. But for the parasympathetic nervous system that relies on acetylcholine, right, there is only the muscarinic kind of receptor that affects the heart rate. So sympathetic and parasympathetic usually are antagonistic to each other, for sure on the heart. So if sympathetic increases heart rate, what does acetylcholine do on the heart in terms of rate? It decreases, right? So acetylcholine has what we call a negative chronotropic effect on the heart. It slows the heart rate down. And here's the strange thing. Even though norepinephrine is a positive inotropic agent, increases force of contraction, acetylcholine has no effect whatsoever on the force of contraction on the heart. So acetylcholine can only change the rate, but not the force of contraction. All right, so that's kind of strange that there's no antagonistic control over force of contraction on the heart. And I'll have to talk about that for, I got 2 months left, why that's important, okay, in the rest of the class. So I think that's an important distinction you should know. Sympathetic is both positive chronotropic and inotropic, but acetylcholine only has a negative chronotropic effect. It doesn't adjust the force of contraction. It just doesn't have those kinds of receptors. Okay. There are different kinds of muscarinic, like we had different kinds of alpha and beta receptors. And I'm not sure how much I will ask you guys about that. I'll have to look and see how many questions I have at the end of the chapter with different kinds of muscarinic receptors. But there's really only one kind of nicotinic receptor, and that is what? Just a ionotropic receptor. If it binds to acetylcholine, the sodium channel opens and depolarizes the cell. Okay. Since I have some important exam figures in this chapter, I want to go over these exam figures when I get my projector back. All right, because I'll for sure go over all those figures for you. But I won't draw those figures out on the board. So, that's all I know for today. Okay, so who's got the sign-in sheet? Did everybody sign the sign-in sheet?
No, I'll
pass it down to the front. And don't give it to that guy. He just walked in. Okay.